From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. An amazing musical story today, the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars, their rise to fame, and why they're stranded in the USA.
Plus more of our conversation about evaluating charities for end-of-year giving.
Don't judge a nonprofit the way that you would judge a company. Judge the nonprofit based on the good that they're doing in the community.
Also, the man known as Potsy, Anson Williams, reflects on his most important mentor, a janitor he knew when he was 15.
Well, I was in such pain, and I didn't consider him an adult. He's the first person that talked to me, not at me. And he healed my heart. The words he said just captured me.
And some seasonally appropriate poetry from Jenny Benjamin and commentary from Abby Lank.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The easing of the Ebola crisis in Africa comes as a relief to public health officials around the world, but even more so to the people in the African countries affected by the crisis, places such as Liberia and Sierra Leone.
The situation in that country is being watched closely by a musical group that's essentially been stranded in the United States since the crisis began. Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars emerged from a refugee camp where its members had ended up in the wake of the country's brutal civil war.
A pair of filmmakers discovered the group and told its story to the world, and their popularity took off. Three original albums followed, along with collaborations with Western bands and concerts around the world.
The group is still waiting to go home, but it's using its extended time in the United States to raise money to support efforts to fight Ebola. They played a benefit concert at UW Milwaukee this month, and several of their members dropped by Studio C1 to chat and play some music, including this song called Cold Water.
Papa government, well body now we problem. Papa government, education now we problem. Papa government, cold water now we problem. Papa government, house rent now we problem. Papa government, yeah, yeah.
Wake up!
Papa government, yeah, yeah.
Wake up!
Give me lili cold water.
Cold water.
Give me lili cold water.
Give me cold water.
Give me lili cold water.
Cold water.
Give me lili cold water.
Give me cold water.
Imanibo badibo.
Agenda.
Imanibo badibo.
Agenda for change.
Imanibo badibo.
Agenda.
Imanibo badibo.
Agenda for change.
Cold Water, Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. Thank you so much. And welcome to Milwaukee.
Yeah, thank you.
You were saying before you played the song that cold water is kind of how people talk about satisfaction where you're from. It must seem like a long time since everyone kind of had cold water in Sierra Leone.
Yeah, you know, in Sierra Leone, it's a country that is blessed with a lot of minerals, and we're still living in poverty. Can you imagine in this present day that in Sierra Leone, not everybody has access to safe drinking water, you know, and that's too bad.
It really is too bad. The three of you and your entire group kind of met and started playing together as the country was really going through a terrible time.
Sure.
And now Sierra Leone is in another really difficult time. It must seem like every time you get through one crisis, another one comes along.
Yeah, it's really unusual. It's strange to me, you know, because, you know, the war really destroyed many things and people are trying to recover from the war, you know, and then there comes this dreadful disease that is killing people in numbers. So it's really something that we don't understand what is going on. And we just believe that the only way is for us to come together and make sure that Sierra Leone becomes an Ebola-free country.
And that's one of the things that you're working on right now. You have started a prevention and awareness campaign, correct?
Yes.
How, and what are you doing to try to make a difference?
Well, actually, we printed a T-shirt that we are selling to raise money so that when we get that money, we will send it back home and help Ebola survivors. We just completed a six-month tour, And we were able to raise money. We started it very late, raising that money very late. And we raised money and helped a local TV station that is operating in Sierra Leone to sensitize people about how to prevent themselves from contracting the disease. It's not that much, but it's $1,000. But I believe it's a good step. And we are moving forward now to raising money and do more things. However, we've been cooperating with some NGOs who are operating in the ground, like MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières. You know, we played many shows for them. They're trying to raise money and help the people out there. And we are very open to doing that with any other NGO, you know, to just help out in our little way.
Now, do I understand it correctly? You were supposed to have gone home to Sierra Leone at the end of that six-month tour, but you have stuck around here because of the Ebola crisis. Is that right?
Sure. That is right. Because normally when we come out of the country, we complete our tour, we go back home and meet our children and wives. But this time around, we are too scared. And, you know, we lost about four members, not the Ebola. But we lost about four members, you know, in the group, very important members. They died. And we don't want to lose any other member again. We want to preserve this group. So that's why we are nervous to go home.
At the same time, you must be concerned about your families back home.
Sure. Every day we are worried. And we spend a lot of money calling them, you know, to just, uplift their spirit. Call them, talk to them, what's going on, and they always give us the information about the bet. We are very lucky that none of them has contracted it.
Would you wish that they could come and join you here? Would you feel more comfortable if you were able to bring them with you around the world?
I think that would be the kulwata. That would be the satisfaction that we would need because, you know, being separated from your loved ones, especially when there is trouble. Yeah, we are used to it, separating from them for 6 months, 7 months. We don't care because we know there is nothing to fear. But now we feel very, very afraid for them, you know. So I think that will be the satisfaction that every member would like.
You came together as refugees from a civil war. Do you feel today, sitting in a place like Milwaukee, that you are still refugees from what's happening in Sierra Leone?
Well, I feel, yes, that I'm a refugee because if I willingly, like formally, we willingly come out. You know something, when you go a place that you are willing to go, that's very good. But when you are not willing to be there at that time and situation forced you to be, I feel like a refugee.
Well, I hope there's another song you might play for us.
I'm going to play Living Like a Refugee. I just took all the problems, the suffering of the people, and make a song of it. Living like a refugee is really not easy. Like a refugee is not easy. It's really not easy.
Living like a refugee,
young man, you know,
is not easy.
We are
living like a refugee is not easy.
You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You will be confronted by strange dialect. You will be fed with unusual diet. You've got to sleep in a tarpaulin house,
which is so hot.
You've got to sleep in a tarpaulin mat,
which is so cold.
Oh, we on time.
Living like a refugee,
Anna,
is not easy.
It's really not easy.
Living like a refugee,
young man, you know,
is not easy. Living like a refugee is not easy.
How is it difficult to stand under the impatiently waiting for your supply? How is it difficult to sit under the sun patiently waiting for your supply? The overcrowding sometimes leads
to the outbreak of a cholera. Eat your bulgur, eat your corn.
It's not easy.
Get your salary, get your job.
It's not easy.
Really not easy.
Living like a refugee,
young man, you know.
It's not easy. Living like a refugee,
young man, you know.
It's not easy.
Now listen to me. No solo play. I love you, I love you
tonight.
I love you, I love you
tonight.
I love you, I love Milwaukee
tonight.
Give me a say. Because we're living, we're living,
we're living.
I say we're living,
we're living,
we're living. I said we're living,
we're living,
we're living. Really not easy.
Living like a refugee is not easy.
Living Like a Refugee, Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. Thank you so much again.
You're welcome.
Living like a refugee is obviously not easy. So how can you sing about it with such joy?
Well, you know, it's something that we are used to doing. We were full-time musicians before we have all these horrible stories. And I believe that music is a way to comfort the soul. Music has helped us to comfort or to reform our lives when the war, you know, sent us to a very bad situation. And it's also helping us right now because we are stuck in the U.S. Anyway, to be candid, it's good to be stuck in the U.S. rather than the refugee camps, you know.
Does it surprise you at all when you think about it? I mean, because I was reading and I think you played your first concert in a refugee camp with a couple of old electric guitars and a secondhand microphone.
Yeah.
Does it amaze you that some years later, here you are traveling around the world and people around the world have taken to your music the way they have?
Yes. For sure, it's like a surprising thing to me, you know, because when we were creating music in the camp, it's just to help reform the lives of our fellow refugees. It's not about coming out of coming to America or Australia. You know, I was not imagining that, to be candid with you. But, you know, I have to acknowledge the efforts of the two American filmmakers and one Canadian who discovered us and saw that, well, these guys have a very good music that Americans should hear, that Australians should hear, that Europeans should hear. So that's how it happened. But it's really amazing.
When you play for a group of Americans, are you comforting their souls in some way? I mean, obviously there's different stuff going on when you're playing for people who are going through a civil war or an Ebola crisis. But I wonder if you think that Americans or Australians or Europeans who listen to your music also feel like they're being comforted from it.
Well, the only way that I can judge from the people that I'm playing music is the way they respond to my music. And after I've played the music, they come to me and tell me different things. And from that, I assess that they really needed our music. Because I don't know, but from what I observe, in Africa, they have physical poverty, but they have emotional happiness. And here, they have physical riches. Everywhere is glory, but they have emotional poverty. Yeah. So I can see people come to me after I've played, they say, thank you for bringing joy to my life. So this makes me feel as if people really are troubled too in the West.
Poverty is a relative term.
Yeah.
As you've had a chance to travel around the West and hear, you know, music that's coming out of the United States and Canada and other places, are there musicians that you would like to play with someday that hopefully if this keeps going for you, you might get to?
Well, we have tried. We hooked up with Aerosmith, big rock stars, and we were very much privileged to be invited by this guy to open up for them. And then they invited us in their studio. We make a song with them. We have two songs with them. And we are ready, really, to hook up with rock stars in America, you know, because music, there is no boundary in music. We love music. And I just believe that all musicians are connected by some way.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for being here and wish you best of luck with your work and with your music. And I really do hope you'll come back and see us again.
Yeah, we're ready.
And do you have one more song you might be able to play for us?
Well, this next song is called Goat Smoke Pipe. A goat cannot smoke pipe, you know. But it's really a song that we wrote because some time ago, before the war, traders, they reserve all the good things for the wealthy people. And the poor people, even if they have money, they will not be able to get needed things like meat. And so we can have the money to purchase the meat, but we can't get it because the rich people have bought everything. So we wrote a song that we talk about shortages of needed things by people. Inaka, inaka, kau cham kasada. Fasalili rabika mamai.
Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars played a concert to benefit Doctors Without Borders at UW-Milwaukee this month. There is a link to more of their Ebola outreach effort at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and when we return, the second part of our conversation about end-of-year charitable giving. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
One day, na me go na cow yard. I go buy me for me model. Now go and they go and meet this cut on a roll. He got to tell me, say, nothing all day again, no. As I turn me face, I see the cow, the jam cassada. I turn me face, I see the go, the smoke pipe. When I ask the cut, what in the apple, so.
More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Yesterday on the program, we talked about some rules of thumb for end-of-year charitable giving as we look toward tax deductions come April 15th.
Our personal finance contributor, Janet Marie Tierney, is back with us this morning to give us some more things to think about. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So we've been talking about charitable donations as the end of the year rolls around and people thinking about how to make them and why they should make them and how they might be deductible come tax season. So let's continue our conversation about this. What are some other things to think about as you go about trying to determine the legitimacy of a charity?
Well, you know, I think it's really important to rely upon personal recommendations. You can go out to a charity website, look at it, and not be overwhelmingly impressed. It's probably done by a volunteer. It's probably not the top line item on their budget priority. You can look at printed materials or a letter that you've received and not find it to be particularly impressive or well written. Again, they're looking to generate income, not to spend money. So don't judge a nonprofit the way that you would judge a company. Judge the nonprofit based on the good that they're doing in the community. I've said this a number of times on this show. 30, 40 years ago, it wasn't unusual for a nonprofit organization to make their appeal by saying, we're dealing with poverty in the greater area. Well, that's great, but today we have better educated, more sophisticated donors who are looking for, well, what are you doing to address poverty? How effective is it? What is it costing you to do that? And I think that's good. It's good for us to be holding these organizations to a higher standard. However, it's a double-edged sword. I hear this a lot, and that people say, well, I'm not going to contribute to that charity because too much of their budget goes to their overhead.
Right. That's a ratio we hear a lot. You know, it's how much do they spend on overhead versus how much are they spending on their mission?
Right. And, you know, I can show you a budget that shows you that my overhead is zero. It's all about how I allocate those costs. The real question we should be asking of nonprofit organizations is how effective are they in addressing the issue that they exist to address? So when somebody says, oh, well, I'm not going to give to that charity because their CEO makes too much money, you know, really, that's not an apples-to-apples comparison. What are you comparing that against? Look at how many employees that CEO has and what the total dollar value is of that overall organization budget, and then compare it to what they would make in the private sector, and now tell me if they're making too much money. And if even if it's equal, that doesn't necessarily mean that's a bad thing. I'm a strong advocate of pay good people good money to do good work. If we're really going to address problems effectively, we need to have the right people in place. And you can't expect those right people to magically appear with the ability to work for free.
Well, and so as you set out to figure out how well these nonprofits are addressing the issue that they set out to do, what are some of the tools you can use to figure out just the kinds of success that they've had?
Well, GuideStar, I know I mentioned in an earlier conversation, GuideStar.com is a website that you can go to that will ask the nonprofits to include metrics in addition to their budgets and their tax reporting so that you can see where the money is going and you can see what they're doing in the community. Annual reports, which are typically found on the nonprofit websites, will also give you some indication as to how effective they are and exactly what they're doing to address community concerns. In addition to that, again, I go back to just person-to-person information. If I come to you and say, I believe in supporting this organization because they are addressing this problem and this is how they're doing it, and here's the kicker, here's how it impacts me, and I'm asking you because this is how it impacts you. Now, there's that much more information. You feel more confident making that donation, and we're working together to improve our community. So never overlook the opportunity to ask someone what organization they support, but also, you know, appreciate that it can be really awkward to ask, too.
Well, and at the same time, if you are a supporter of a particular organization, it's not always the most comfortable conversation to have, but it's a good way to build support for the kinds of things that you support.
Right. And as from an organizational standpoint, the highest rate of success for any donations that they're attempting to solicit is not going to come from, you know, kind of a televised appeal or an event. It's going to come from the conversation I have with you that tells you why it's important to me and tells you why it's important to you. Those asks always, they might not always yield the highest dollar amount, but they have the highest rate of success.
Talk a little bit about the concept of matching gifts, because there are a lot of employers out there that this is one of the things that they offer.
Right. Employers will do it. So check to see if your employer does it. If you're making a contribution and you provide paperwork to the nonprofit organization, they're able to say, okay, Janet has given us this money. We understand that you have a matching gift program. So she's given $50. Then that charity can expect a gift of $50 from my employer to match my contribution. Now, there's another type of matching donation that's out there, and that is the kind of the corporate-sponsored charitable giving. So you might do something on a bank's platform, such as my employer, Fiserv, offers something called Pop Money. Pop Money is a service that is available for banks. So we have banks in the local area who are using this. And if you use that, your bank, to make these dollar transfers using Pop Money, a percentage of that transaction is going to be given to charity. It's also a person-to-person tool for transferring money. So you can earn money for a charity just by paying someone you owe money to. And it's also a tool that can be used to give money directly to the charity, in which case there's a matching contribution and fees are waived. There are a number of things like that. There are a number of corporate-sponsored matching grant programs that are free to you. You don't have to be using something that involves a financial transaction like Pop Money. A great one out there is called Charity Miles. It's a free app on your smartphone. It's GPS-based. If you're running or walking, which hopefully you're doing anyway, you can earn 25 cents a mile for the charity of your choice. If you're biking, it's 10 cents a mile. And that's corporate-sponsored, so there's no dollars out of your pocket to helping out a charity.
In the end, are these miles and the donations that go along with them tax deductible?
No, because it's not money coming out of your pocket. It's going to be tax deductible to the corporation who is donating the money.
That's what's in it for them, obviously.
Right. And what's in it for them isn't just the tax deduction. It's also that you get to know, hey, this business helped me give 25 cents or 10 cents a mile to the charity of my choice. Perhaps when I'm looking to buy the product or service that they deliver, that's where I'm going to look first.
Janet Marie Tierney, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Janet Marie Tierney is a volunteer financial educator and our personal finance contributor. She's also a senior business analyst at Fiserv.
The holiday season is a time many of us spend with family and with memories of family, as we hear in the words of Milwaukee poet Jenny Benjamin.
This poem is called Eastwood, and it's one of my favorite kinds of poems to write because it was inspired by my family, my sister and my dad. Here it goes, Eastwood. My dad, makeshift through and through, fashioned catch-alls out of manila folders strapped to car visor flaps. He buttressed broken furniture legs with wood, nothing a 2x4 couldn't fix, he always used to say, and taught all of his kids how to tame a station wagon's frenetic butterfly valve with an ink pen, or stave off jammed motor blades with a pickup stick game. Dad was 70s crafty, with paneled planks of wood lining the sectioned basement, corner bedroom, pool table, shag carpeting, velour couch, shimmering under strobe lights like bioluminescent fish bottom feeding. So years later, after his death, when his crush, hammered slightly askew, wears his penned writing of 152 East Wood Street on the underside of baby Jesus, Mary, Joseph, the three wise men, shepherd and each sheep or donkey, I am overcome by the care he took in me and my whole family. As such, should one member of the nativity spin aloft on an unruly wind, past suburbs, small towns, rural sprawls of corn, it could be found again and delivered home.
Milwaukee poet and writer Jenny Benjamin reading Eastwood. She's author of the novel This Most Amazing and a young adult trilogy currently up for nominations through the Kindle Scout program. There are links and you can read Jenny's poem at WUWM.com.
TV stars are a little like family, right? Okay, maybe that overstates it. But our next guest is someone many of us welcomed into our homes for years in the 1970s and 80s. A Milwaukee sort of homecoming for Anson Williams, better known as Potsy, from Happy Days, when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. This Sunday marks the shortest day of the year.
No, it doesn't. Days are days, no matter when they fall on the calendar.
You and essayist Avi Lank have been talking, haven't you?
Sunday is the solstice, an important marker in the progression of the year. From time immemorial, mankind has noted when the sun stops its southern progression and begins to move back north. In places as far-flung as the Peruvian Andes and southwestern England, our ancient ancestors paid homage to the solstice in public ceremonial structures, in those cases Machu Picchu and Stonehenge, respectively. Elsewhere in the Northern Hemisphere, where the December solstice marks a dark time of the year, great religions responded by creating festivals near it containing real or spiritual light, Hanukkah for Jews, Christmas for Christians. The solstice occurs when, at noon, the sun is directly over one of the tropical latitudes, the Tropic of Cancer in June and the Tropic of Capricorn in December. This year, that is at 5:03 p.m. Sunday in Milwaukee. This endless progression is easily understood and appreciated. But I have always had a problem with how many people describe the event. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, we tend to call the December solstice the shortest day of the year, while the June one is termed the longest. It is just the opposite in the Southern Hemisphere, of course. But that is not right. What people mean is that the December solstice has the least possible amount of sunshine of any day of the year, while the one in June has the most possible sunshine. This is an entirely different thing from saying that the days vary in length. Actually, every day has 24 hours, or 1,440 minutes, or 86,400 seconds. Well, sort of. Occasionally, a leap second is added to keep atomic clocks in sync with the actual rotation of the Earth, which varies because of things like tides and the moon. The last leap second was added on June 30th, 2012. Scientists also calculate time on Earth by looking at quasars and can further complicate things by taking into account that the Earth's orbit is at times eccentric and that the equator is not aligned with that orbit. Including all of this makes the calculation of time exceedingly complicated, spinning the head of a math-phobic amateur such as me. Instead, I like to revel in the comforting clockwork of the universe made obvious by the progression of the sun, demarked by the solstices, a universal constant influencing custom, belief, and religion throughout human history. That is certainly something worth celebrating. Just don't refer to Sunday as the shortest day of the year. It isn't. Probably.
Abby Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He's an occasional panelist on the Interchange program on Milwaukee Public Television, and he's co-author of the forthcoming book, The Man Who Painted the Universe, coming out in June. He lives in Whitefish Bay.
It was hard to interview Anson Williams without the nagging feeling that his voice reminded me of someone.
Williams has done a lot of things, from acting to producing and directing to starting a business that produces makeup. But it's a single role that endears him to millions of television viewers.
And so it hit me that his voice reminds me precisely of Patsy Weber, the hapless and happy-go-lucky character he played for 10 years on the Milwaukee set sitcom Happy Days. Williams has a new memoir, Singing to a Bulldog, is based on lessons he learned from the unlikely mentor he had as a teenager. Williams will be in Milwaukee today, but ahead of his visit, he's with us by phone. Anson Williams, so nice to meet you.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be on.
So it's been 30 years since Happy Days ended its run on network TV, and you have had a distinguished career that has included producing, directing, many other acting parts, and as an entrepreneur. And yet, on the cover of your book, there you are as Patsy. Is it safe to assume you don't mind that image that people still have of you from as long ago as 40 years?
I wanted to have an emotional attachment to the book. And I just thought, you know, that picture, I think, would bring a smile and get people to open it and to start reading that book with good feelings and a connection.
Absolutely. I mean,
the whole book is about connection. So it was actually a gift to be able to use that picture.
It is. I think when you say the name Anson Williams, it is probably the image most people have is of, if not this exact picture, but certainly a picture along those lines.
It's interesting. We've been fortunate, the entire cast, in being able to do so many other things. I mean, I sang Elmer Griffin 25 times. You know, had my own, you know, variety special through the years. Other acting parts. We go on TV promoting the projects we direct. So I think they're familiar with the character and also who we are as people too, because we've been around long enough to be able to, you know, to accomplish that. But it was interesting when Happy Days started. You know, I wasn't used to that kind of popularity at all, and especially not being called a character name when you've been called your name
right,
your whole life.
Right.
And I complained to Ron Howard, and Ron said, "What are you complaining about? I got Richie and I got Opie." And then he said something really wise. He said that, you know, Anson, we have to earn our names. We have to do other things to earn our names. And that was very insightful and life-changing for me.
Well,
and I think all of us through the years, you know, especially Henry and Ron, myself, Don Most, we've earned our names too.
I think there's an anecdote you tell in the book about the four of you, or maybe it might be that Ron Howard was not there, but one of the first times you all went to a publicity appearance on behalf of Happy Days, and at one point Henry Winkler turns to you and says, "This was more exciting than my bar mitzvah."
Right. It's true. It's true. I mean, here we are, four young guys, you know, fighting for dates, and all of a sudden you're hot. You know, and when Happy Days went on the air, it was a very short schedule for its premiere on the network, and we were constantly working to keep up with the show. So we really didn't know the popularity of the show. We'd get to work when it's dark, we'd leave when it's dark, and finally they. We had enough shows ahead where we were able to actually go on a promo tour, which none of us, other than Ron, had ever been on anything like that. And Ron couldn't make the first couple of dates because of a previous commitment. So the three of us were flown to Houston. And right off the plane, we knew things had changed because there was a limo on the tarmac. We felt like the Fab Three. We're going, oh, my God. And we... immediately from the airport, we were driven to the first event, which was some fashion show at an outside amphitheater in some park on the outskirts of Houston. So we're driving up there and, you know, kind of taking it all in, and we get to this, you know, park, and we're going through this long drive, and we see ahead of us just thousands of people. And we turn to each other, thinking, you know, man, something big must be going on. Must be a concert or something going on. Never thinking it's us. All of a sudden, they turn and thousands of screaming teenagers, girls, are like running to this limo. You know, if you want to win any war in the world, just bring a few thousand young screaming teenage girls. You know, they will kick anyone's butt. They come down. It's us. It's us. They start... the limo's going. It was like Forrest Gump. This outside experience. What are we doing here? They're almost lifting the car up. The police come. They're taking us out. They're tearing at our clothes. All of a sudden we get thrown in the back of this of the inside of this amphitheater, and as loud as it was outside, that's how quiet it was inside. And we're just looking at each other, going, "What the heck? I mean, what the heck?" They put on wireless mics. And they tell us, you know, there's 30,000 people waiting to see you in the amphitheater and the outside amphitheater. The biggest crowd in the history of that theater. And there was this little fashion show going on, and we were just supposed to go out and wave. So they said, "We'll tell you when." So all of a sudden, here's, you know, three schmoes, Henry, myself, and Don, walk onto the stage, and the screaming was almost at fainting level. And we're looking at each other. What the heck? And then finally, Henry just looks at me and looks at Don, and finally just goes, "Hey," with his thumb. "Forget about it. Forget about it." So I turn to Don, and I say, "Hey, Don, I think we're going to get lucky." And that was the beginning of the ride.
Well, so let me ask about the book. You frame it with the lessons that you write that you gained from your stint working as a janitor's apprentice, essentially, when you were a teenager. Yeah, okay. Assistant janitor. It came at a time, you know, these were not the happiest of teenage years for you.
No, actually, my upbringing was harsh. My dad came out of World War II, and it was harsh. And because of it, I was pretty much a mess. I knew everything I did wrong. I didn't know anything I did right. I was confused. I was just so unconfident. And, you know, we didn't have money. So anything extra you wanted in life, you had to go out and get a job and pay for, which is fine. And I got a job at 15 years old at Leonard's Department Store in Burbank. And they hired me as an assistant janitor, and the head janitor was a man by the name of Willie Turner, who was African-American, in his 50s, illiterate, and a functional alcoholic. But what Without this man, I wouldn't be talking to you today. This man was the first man to ever talk to me, not at me. He called his janitorial room the talk room. And there'd be two oil drum cans in there and then janitorial supplies and whatever. And when we weren't working, he would talk to me. He had such an innate sense of who I was, what I was good at. He knew how to inspire me. He gave me life lessons I couldn't pay for. Again, without him, I'd be less than a number in the world. And the book, you know, yes, is 30 stories of that are fun and entertaining and maybe insightful and maybe interesting to people, but there's always a bigger story in each story. It takes the reader back to the talk room where they can have a chance to meet Willie. They would have a chance to have the same words that inspire me to help me find myself. Like Willie would tell me, boy, don't get in the way of yourself. You don't get in the way of yourself, you know? And you don't look at the mountain. You climb the mountain, boy. You move forward. You climb the mountain. That's who wins, boy. I mean, lesson after lesson in terms of priority and clarity. In fact, the reason for the title, Singing to a Bulldog, that same first year at 15, we were unpacking refrigerators for the appliance department. And back then, the big deal was that the freezer compartment didn't freeze up. It just stayed cold. So I look at Willie and I say, you know, they should put up a sign, freeze your food, not your freezer. He goes, that's good, boy. That's a gift. You got the words to sell. You find opportunity. That's a gift. You use that right. That's powerful. You got a gift. It's the first time I knew I had entrepreneurial abilities. 2 days later, there's a banner across the entire appliance department. Freeze your food, not your freezer. Willie had talked to the manager. They sold out of refrigerators. Do you know what that meant to me, this 15-year-old unconfident kid who's never done anything great in his life? To have my idea there for the world to see, and it actually was positive, it worked, it changed my life. Well, aside from many more lessons and inspiring conversations, that particular find that Willie found in me, years later I used on Happy Days, always looking for the opportunity.
And so this kind of connects with where the book gets its title, right?
Back then we weren't paid the same kind of salary stars are today, nowhere near. We did fine, but you don't get rich.
Right.
So I'm looking for opportunity, like on the show. How can I improve myself? Where is there more opportunity? How can I grow? How can I climb my mountain? And then it hit me. David Cassidy's singing on the Partridge Family. He has a record contract. He's singing all over the world, off the show. The Brady Bunch, they're singing now off the show, record contract. Well, I sang in nightclubs and all that years before, and I thought to myself, if I can convince Gary Marshall to put a band on the show with me singing, I could get a record contract, and I can get booked for concerts all over this country, and I can make some money. So I tracked Gary down. He didn't have a lot of time, and he told me, hey, I don't have what? Talk to me later. I don't have a lot of time. I go, no, it'll only take a minute. He said, you only got a minute. So I had an elevator pitch to change my life. He goes, walk with me. So I'm walking with Gary, and I quickly tell him, you got girls on the show. You got cars on the show. You don't have music. You need a band. We'll have a band at Arnold's. Richie can be in it. Ralph can be in it. I sing. It'll be great for the show. Wait a minute. He stops me. Wait a minute. A band? And you sing. Yeah, you sing, right? I go, yeah, yeah. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. You're good? I'm okay. Ah, a band. I like that. I used to be a drummer. Okay. There's a show coming up. A frat party. I can fit it in the show. Go pick a song. Go to Bobby in the office. Go pick a song. Yeah, that's a good idea. Starts walking away. I'm thinking to myself, I just changed my life. I'm singing on national television. I'm going to get a record deal. Oh my! And then he turns back to me. But Anson, what? You're singing to a bulldog. Why? Well, I don't have time to listen to you. If you're good, I get laughs. If you're bad, I get laughs. You're singing to a bulldog. So there I was, the first time on national television, singing I'm All Shook Up to a bulldog. But that moment of singing to that bulldog was more than just music. Gary liked it. He put the band in numerous episodes. I was in charge of the music that I did on the show, which gave me another responsibility, which was just a great education. I got a record contract. I started getting booked all over the country, and I made much more money off the show than on the show. So singing to a bulldog was the precise moment when I started to climb my mountain. Jump the Shark came from Happy Days. The precise moment when success starts to decline, singing to a bulldog is the precise moment when you start to climb. And I wanted the book to have that same inspiration for all the readers, where by reading this book and by paying Willie Turner's lessons forward, they will have the tools to start to climb, to have their bulldog moment.
Can I ask about the concept of jumping the shark? Because it's kind of entered the popular lexicon, and it goes well beyond Happy Days. In fact, people might not even think of it as coming from Happy Days.
Yeah.
Was there an awareness of jumping the shark as the shark was literally being jumped?
No, not at all. In fact, it's interesting because I think that was only the fifth season of the show. It went on for 10 years. So it really wasn't the start of the decline of Happy Days. The jump the shark moment for Happy Days to me was when Ron and Henry left, because the it factor of that show was the chemistry.
Yeah.
And you can't repeat it. That to me, the seventh or eighth season, that to me was the jump the shark moment, honestly. But I want jump the shark moment. I want singing the bulldog. I want the bulldog moment to be as popular as the jump the shark moment, because it's the polar opposite. It's the pause. It's climbing, not declining.
You met Willie Turner when you were 15.
Yes.
That's an age when teenagers don't always want to listen to adults. Was there something about Willie at the time you were 15 that made you sit up and take notice?
Oh, yeah. I was in such pain, and I didn't consider him an adult. He's the first person to talk to me, not at me. And he healed my heart. The words he said just captured me. And turn my head around into a positive place. And every day I found out more I could do instead of what I couldn't do. Because of him, I had the clarity and the confidence and the strength to move forward. So, it didn't even dawn on me not to listen to him. It's just everything connected that he said to me.
One of the things, remarkable things you write about was your being there when Robin Williams was given the chance to play Mork from Ork in an episode of Happy Days, which many people forget, which then spun off to become Mork and Mindy. You say right away people recognized his genius. I was just wondering if you would reflect on a life cut short as Robin's was.
I can reflect more on his what's going to be forever. You know, I mean, Robin was the kindest, most gentle man ever. Maybe too sensitive to the human condition. And I don't, you know, and a lot of times that kind of genius, you know, I just don't know what went through him, what he had to put up with to have that kind of sensitivity and that kind of connection and that kind of clarity of what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. It had to be so complex. So I'm not about to judge. You know, a long life, short life. All I know is during his life, he's given more than most people do in 10 lifetimes. And those 10 lifetimes are going to be around for 10 more lifetimes. His genius, his abilities to make people laugh and educate and understand are evergreen and forever.
Well, I know our time is relatively short in this interview, but I wanted to ask, have you visited Milwaukee in recent years?
The last time I was there was for the Bronze the Fonz dedication.
Well, I was going to ask if there is a picture of the real Potsy, if you will, with the fake Fonz.
The real Potsy with the fake Fonz. You mean Anson with the fake Fonz?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, sure. I'm sure there are. They took tons of pictures that day.
Would you wish that there were a Potsy statue nearby?
I don't wish it. I wouldn't mind it, but I don't wish it.
Well,
how about a gold one?
A gold Potsy.
Then I'd have security and the Fonz wouldn't.
Well, I have to say one of the recurring themes that comes through in the course of reading the stories in this book and the important events in your life is the ones who are most important to you seem like people that were generous in their time and their willingness to reach out to others.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that you have been very generous with your time.
You know, paying it forward is what it's about, you know, and I just having had the opportunity to start with nothing and then meet so many fantastic people in this world, inventors, leaders, entertainers, but having lived long enough to know the most magical person was someone no one knew. And it became very clear to me that someone you think is so ordinary can be so extraordinary to your life. That's Willie Turner, and I try to live the lessons he taught me. And hopefully the book will inspire and connect with everyone who reads it.
Well, Anson Williams, I hope we can all sing to a bulldog. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Anson Williams' new memoir is called Singing to a Bulldog. Williams, who is best known as Potsy on Happy Days, will sign copies of his book later this morning at the Atrium at Schlitz Park. And with that, we turn the page on another edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Our production team this week includes the interview and mixing talents of Dan Harmon, web support from Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering by John Strelecki, and production assistance from Audrey Nowakowski and Nino Erba.
Have a great weekend. Hope you finish your holiday shopping, if you haven't already. And hope you can fit us into your plans. Lake Effect Weekend is tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We are your NPR station in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.